What's up, guys? My name is Emerson, your favorite manic and melanated photographer.
Hey, hey, this is Alex, or you can call me Peach, your local content creator and fruit enthusiast.
And welcome to the Photo Bros Podcast.
Your one-stop shop for all things photography, videography, and content creation.
Hey, what's up, everybody? This is episode 16, and I'm here solo because Peach decided to get a stomach bug last night. And so it's going to be me and your boy, producer Shane, here leading this episode today. And we have a very, very, very amazing guest. We have Mike T with us today. How's it going, Mike?
Hey, how's it going, guys? And Peach, I hope you're feeling a lot better. Thanks for having me on the show.
Awesome. We're glad to have you here. Can you tell the people like just a little bit of your background, what you do, your experience in the creative world?
Well, right now I'm the photo editor for the Air and Space Forces magazine for the Air and Space Forces Association. And I came to the association after leaving USA Today, where I spent almost 23 years as the photo editor for the front page and for digital operations. Prior to that, I came from the Honolulu Star Bulletin in Hawaii, which was part of the Gannett Group, which owned USA Today. And prior to that, I was a wire service photographer for the Associated Press in Hawaii for a few years.
Wow, that's an impressive resume, definitely. But anyways, let's get into it. First off, I want to, because you just have so many years of experience, I've got to ask you about lighting fundamentals. So Peach and I, we've done an episode on it, and we've given our two cents about lighting. But let's hear what basically you have to say about lighting, because it seems like you have about like what, two decades of experience in the photography world, the photo and creative world. And I just, what is the secret to getting perfect lighting when it comes to photography?
Well, you know, I come from a photojournalism background. So a lot of times we don't have a lot of time to actually set things up. So you have to sort of assess the situation and see what are you trying to portray with the subject. For example, you know, if it's an author who writes a lot of detective novels or mystery novels, you want to really have a sort of a hard light to create that air of mystery. You know, hard light means, you know, it's unfiltered. You're not using any sort of bounce on it. Basically, it's like an electronic flash or a straight bulb shining straight on, either Rembrandt light, three-quarter light, and casting some pretty strong shadows in the background. Now, on the other hand, you're not going to use that type of light if you're shooting someone for, let's say, a fashion spread or a food spread. What you want to do is you really want to soften that light. So you want to use a lot of diffusers. And your best friend is one of those little, I guess, portable reflectors.
Yeah.
the ones you really want to get are like a white or a translucent that you can really bounce that or soften that light through. And unlike a hard light, you really want to bring that light a little more like over your shoulder at 45 degrees and soften it. Or even you can move it behind your subject, you know, and bounce the light from that's coming from the back to the front with a reflector and shooting it. So that'll give the subject a nice halo rim light effect. So I don't know what you guys do. I know you shoot a lot of video.
Yeah, I do. I do a mixture of video and photo. Most of the time I use natural light. I'm pretty much a natural light guy. I've wanted to dive into like using reflectors and a few modifiers as well in regards to that, but I've just never really taken that next step into like using reflectors or even like some V flats as well to try to just customize the light in a way that I would like. Usually I just use whatever is available to me.
Yeah, when we shoot video, if you're going for that cinematic look, you really want to soften that light. You want to control the light.
Very true.
So like if we're shooting in this room, you really want to, first of all, turn off all your light sources. And then from there, you start building your lights, like your building blocks. For instance, is it going to be a dramatic scene? Is it going to be a night scene? Is it going to be a broad daylight scene? All of that will come into consideration when you're building your light. So basically, like if you have a window, so you want to put a light, take a meter reading, and then put the light up, put a diffuser in front of it. And then the next thing you do is your background. Your background is going to be dark. So you want to have a light in your background. And the mood would be, you know, are you going to go tungsten? Or are you going to go daylight balanced? All of that gives you a different look, which means tungsten, you're going to have that sort of nice tan background, brownish, orangey background. Or if you want a... more like a daylight band, you're going to have a blue background, bluish tint colored background.
Interesting.
It all depends on what color temperature of your light as your source in the background.
Yeah, this is great information because I actually just started getting into like writing short films and filming short films, like many 3-4 minute films. And so I'm still somewhat learning about cinematic lighting and everything of that nature, but that was some great information. I'm definitely going to make sure I make note of that and use it in my next project.
Yeah. Always keep track of what your color temperature is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the lower the color temperature, the warmer your light source, the higher your color temperature, the more bluish your light source. So that's why you see some of these flat panel lights that are called bicolor. So you can adjust the color on those light panels to be, you know, from 5600 Kelvin all the way down to, you know, 23, 30. So you can just dial in what you need at that point. But also keep in mind that for those effects, you have to also change the color balance in your camera.
Yeah.
So you have to keep that in mind too. You know, if you change the color balance on your lights, but you don't balance your camera to your main light source, then you're going to have problems.
Yeah, that's going to be a pain in post.
Right. It's going to be a very big pain.
Yeah.
Yeah, like if you want that background to be that bluish, you know, you want your light source in the camera to reflect more of a tungsten. So.
Amazing.
Yeah, so there's give and take on both sides there.
Awesome. Yeah, that was some amazing information. I can't wait to use it on my next project, definitely.
It's hard to explain it,
I got every single word, yeah. definitely. But anyways, Peach and I, we both kind of like giving our photography a more moody type of feel to it. If a client or somebody you're collabing with approached you and asked you for moody lighting, what would your approach be? What questions would you ask to better understand the final product that they wanted?
Well, if they approached me for a moody shot, I would say, first of all, what is the topic that requires this moody lighting?
Yeah.
You know, is it going to be more sci-fi or more mystery or more horror? Mm. That in itself, you know, will dictate how you're going to light the scene. If it's more horror type, you know, you want the lighting to be more from the bottom, lighting your subject from the bottom to create those shadows, you know, below the eyes and above. Mm-hmm. And a sci-fi look would be more three-quarter light, backlight with a rim.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd color balance it more towards daylight, but take the color balance in the camera a bit more into the tungsten side to get that more
interesting, you know,
weird sci-fi type lighting effects.
Awesome. All right, great information. Like, usually when I hear moody, all I think of is kind of like deep shadows and just split lighting and things of that nature. But hearing like, if they want sci-fi, if they want horror, I never really like thought that there was like a difference in between everything until you just pointed that out. And now I'm thinking about like horror movies that I've seen and sci-fi movies that I've seen, and seeing the way the lighting is and the differences, it makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, a horror movie too. I mean, just because it's a horror movie though, don't think that that you have to use that type of lighting.
Yeah.
A lot of times it's content too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a softly lit, well-lit scene can be horror in itself, depending on the topic. But usually the lighting means you want to dim, first of all, like I said, you want to turn off all your lights and start building block at a time your lighting scenario. So you're going to be using several lights
mm-hmm.
to build this. You probably want a main light, depending on the subject and how you're going to light the subject. It could be a one person, two persons, you know. How are you going to do the shot? First thing, you know, just think about how you're going to do the shot
mm-hmm.
and then build your lighting from there.
Amazing. Amazing. Again, Mike, great information. I'm literally going to take notes from this episode big time and step my game up a little bit. But speaking of stepping up my game, for the more seasoned photographers here, what are some advanced lighting techniques that you would give beginner or an intermediate photographer to like step up their game, advanced lighting techniques?
Basically, it all depends on what you're going to do as far as, is it going to be photography or is mm-hmm. it going to be video? Now, if it's going to be photography, two ways you can do it. You can do it with strobes, electronic strobes, mm-hmm. or the constant light scenario where you use LED flat panels or high power LED lights
mm-hmm.
would be for still photography. The one good thing about using flat panels or constant light LED type of light is that what you see is what you get.
Very true.
You can move that light around and you can see exactly what you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing to do though is if you're going to be using it for portraiture, then definitely you have to run it through. I'd run it through a softbox.
Yeah.
Or I'd, you know, you have to soften that light. A lot of these, the more basic lights, they come with a plastic flat panel on it to diffuse it. Mm-hmm. And that's not really enough. What you have to do is you have to run it through some sort of diffusion to get that really soft look. And you would need at least, I'd say, three lights. I would say one is your main, one for a hair light, and one for a background light. You can get away without using a background light, but I think a background light adds more dimension to your subject, and it would be a good idea to get one of those. The type of light to get, like I said before, bicolor.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also RGB lights.
Yes.
Now, those RGB lights are really handy because you can physically change the color of your background. Mm-hmm. If you got a plain white backdrop, You can make that backdrop any color you need.
Yep.
You know, green, red, blue, orange, just dial it in and it would be great. For video, it would be wise to more or less have your lights more high powered because you'd be lighting a lot larger areas sometimes.
Yeah, definitely.
So there's no such thing as not having enough power. It's better to have more than not enough.
Sweet. Now that we've basically covered lighting and I've learned so many things that I did not know. And so I'm going to go home and try out some new techniques. Thanks to Mike. I just want to let's dive into lenses. Talk to us about some of the lenses that you use and how you use them.
Okay. I have the basic trifecta, 14-24 2.8, 24-70 2.8, 70-200 2.8.
Nice.
I also have a wide variety of other lenses that I use, 300 2.8, 500 f/4s, you know, on the long side.
Mm-hmm.
The bread and butter lens, if you have to just get one lens, would be a 24-70 2.8. With that, you can cover anything. Now, more recently, I've been trying out this Tamron. It's a 35-150.
Oh, wow.
F2-2.8.
Wow.
I was kind of, you know, my equipment right now, I have 1 foot in the DSLR era and mm-hmm. 1 foot in the mirrorless era.
Yep.
So I can use my DSLR lenses on my mirrorless system. And I wanted to get another lens, but not duplicate. Like, I didn't want to get two 24-70 2.8s. The 35-150 was something that intrigued me. Because what that means is instead of carrying two lenses, like a 24-70 and a 70-200, you can basically cover an event with one lens.
That's impressive.
You know, yeah. And I've used it for several events now and it exceeded my expectations. It's extremely sharp, wide open, which really surprised me. You know, this is a third party manufacturer. It's a Tamron. And I'm running on Nikon mirrorless.
Nice.
And it really cut down on the load that you have to carry. It's a great events, wedding type of lens to use. And it sort of takes the place of the 24-70. You don't get the wide end as much. I mean, I carry a secondary lens that's like a, right now, if I'm using that combo, I've used a 16-35 that has VR in it. So, mm-hmm. you know, it works out. But you could also carry a 21.8 and that 35-150 and you'd be covered. You can also go up, use the 35-150 as a 50-225 zoom lens if you go into a DX crop or a, you know, APS-C crop APS-C, yep. on your camera.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that one lens kind of does it all. But I'd be happy with either the 24-70 2.8 or this other lens, 35-150. It's pretty mm-hmm. good.
Yeah, I've always wanted a 24-70 2.8, but I always like, I don't know. I'm more of a prime lens guy. So I use a 16mm 2.8 and I also use a 50-1.8 for all of my shots. I'm still thinking about going into a zoom lens phase, get a 24-70 2.8, but I just haven't because I'm just so used to prime lens.
I also have prime lenses.
Mm-hmm.
But the things that I cover
mm-hmm.
tend to be rapidly changing and breaking thing, you know, breaking news type of thing, mm-hmm. where the situation changes a lot. Mm-hmm. So I really don't have time to change a lens. Yeah. If I have time to do it, mm-hmm. If I have time to carry a prime, I will carry a prime. Mm-hmm. You know, my primes, I have a 21.8, 28.18. I have two 50s. I have a 51.8 and a 51.2.
Oh.
The 1.2 is a beast of a lens.
Yeah.
But, boy, that shallow depth of field really makes the subject pop.
It, yeah, definitely.
You know, and I have the 85.18.
Nice.
Again, you know, you could cover anything with those lenses. It all depends on what you're going to do. I mean, are you going to do events, or are you going to do portraiture, or are you going to do things where, you know, you don't have that rapidly changing situation? Mm-hmm. Primes definitely have their advantage because you can go into much lower light and you can really throw that background out of focus with good bokeh. You know, you shoot it wide open.
Yep. I love bokeh.
I mean, the 28-70 2.8 is great, but... You know, you shoot with a lens with a lower f-stop, and then you can physically tell that.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Now, since we talked about lenses, I have a question. So, like, for different scenarios when it comes to photography, what lens would be perfect for, like, a situation kind of like somebody wants a portrait in an alleyway? Or a portrait in the middle of a field, what lenses would be perfect in different situations? Because I think you covered like all of your lenses, and I was just like, how do you choose which one to use depending on the situation?
Okay.
Yep.
The selection of the lens is going to depend a lot on what the photographer wants to show. Mm-hmm. If you're going to photograph somebody in an alley, is the background interesting enough to include more details? So if that's the case, I would go more with a 35 or a 50, which, you know, you would show enough of the subject. You can get close enough to the subject, yet include more of the background to make things interesting. If you went straight to an 85 or a 105, you could blur out more of the background through a higher, you know, lower aperture and, you know, just pretty much isolate the subject right there. But if you want more of an environmental portrait type of shot, I would go with a wider lens, a 35, a 50. You could use a 24 or 28, but I would be really careful about where you position your subject you don't really want to start stretching the person's head too much, because anytime you use a wide lens, that's the problem you have. You want to keep your subject more or less in the middle and not towards the edges.
Yeah.
Like an open field, you know, definitely you could, if you want to show the expanse of the field with the person there, you could shoot a 20.
Nice.
You know, include everything.
Yep.
And then you could narrow it down using a 35 or a 50. Mm-hmm. If you want a really nice blurry background with the subject popping out, again, 85 or 105. Even a 135, but when you start getting to the higher, longer lenses, you're really cutting down on what the background, where the background will be really thrown out of focus. Now, if you're shooting in an area that has a very, like, busy background, you know, like you're on a city street, and you really want that person to pop, you know, you could shoot with a 200 or even a 300 millimeter.
Nice.
Just open it up to 2.8 or f2, and you could really throw that background out of focus. but also have enough interesting things going around and having that subject pop out too.
Amazing.
Hey, Mike, just wanted to jump in with a quick question here on what you said earlier. How do you determine what aspects of the background are worth including, and how do you filter out what should be left out?
You really want to be careful of things like pipes or stanchions or trees going through the people's heads, or flagpoles or telephone poles growing out of people's heads. Who has not done that? Guilty person right here in the podcast. You really got to be careful and cognizant of what's going on with that background at all times.
Yep.
I mean, it's easy to become focused in on the subject that the background elements tend to get lost. But, I mean, you really got to take a good look through that viewfinder to make sure you don't have any of that stuff going on. Because when you get back and edit your images, you look at that and go, oh, you just blew it. You know, it's like it was a great shot, but it's ruined with the telephone pole sticking out the middle of the head.
Gosh, reminds me of some of my first work I did 6 years ago. I look at my old work and I'm just like, what was I thinking? But you got to start somewhere sometimes.
Oh, I do that all the time. I look at it, it's like, oh my, Mike, come on, what are you doing?
Yeah. But while we're on the topic of like our beginnings, I wanted to ask, what gear would you say that a beginner definitely does not need, like when you're first starting out, like first time you get a camera, first few months into your photography journey?
If you're first starting out as a photographer, the most important thing is to get good glass.
Yep.
Okay. Get good glass. The body is secondary. It's that old saying, you know, you marry your glass, you date your body.
Oh, wow.
So your glass will go with you for years.
Wow.
Your body can be updated, you know, next year. I would say for someone starting out, buy the best glass that you can afford.
Perfect.
Okay, buy the best glass you can afford. The body, you know, something that's okay is fine. You'll be amazed that if you get some of these, you know, so-called amateur bodies, yet you put like a 24 to 72 weight on it, at what you can get out of that.
Yes, definitely.
You know, the quality on that. Yeah. Will make a big, big difference. So buy glass, good glass first, body second.
Yeah, I started out on a Canon Rebel T7i, and I think one time I put on 100mm f/2.8, and just seeing the quality of that shot, I was just like, there's no way I'm using a T7i in creating this type of picture. Right. So I always tell people, get a great lens before you decide to spend $5,000 on a new body, because if it's all about the lens and the person using the camera. Anybody can create great pictures. You just got to know what you're doing and using the right equipment as well.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing too is to get out there and shoot.
Yeah.
You know, the more you shoot, the better you're going to get. And don't be afraid to make those mistakes. The more mistakes you make, the better you're going to get. You know, you're going to hopefully learn from those mistakes.
Yeah. I made a lot of mistakes in the beginning of my journey.
And Let me tell you, it's a lot cheaper for you to make those mistakes nowadays. You know, I'm going to tell you one thing. The scientists were wrong. Dinosaurs are not extinct. There's one sitting here right across from you right now. Okay? I came up in the era of film.
Oh, wow.
And manual focus, everything, manual cameras, manual focus.
Oh, my gosh.
So when I was learning, your mistakes were kind of expensive.
I can imagine.
You know.
Yeah.
And you didn't find out you made a mistake till you processed the film.
Ooh.
you don't have that instant review.
Yeah.
Yeah, you had to wait till you got back and process the film and you look at it and go, uh-oh, look at that. It's all blank. What happened?
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah.
That's wild.
But with digital photography nowadays, you can go out there and just, you know, you're only limited by the size of your memory card.
Exactly. Yeah. All right, let's talk about careers now. Well, your career. What's it like being an in-house photographer for a publication, and how did you get there?
I started off being interested in photography since middle school. You know, I worked for the school paper back then. They didn't have a photographer, so I said, oh, I'll do it. And the camera I had was a Polaroid Land camera.
Oh, wow.
So instant pictures, you know, which we put into the school paper. I kept my interest going throughout high school and college. I got a journalism degree and a communications degree. In the communications degree, I learned a bit about video and how to edit video. Mm-hmm. It's not how you edit video today. It was basically doing film, so cutting and splicing film together.
Oh, wow.
Or using the newfangled equipment called Betamax deck. So learning how to edit video on videotape. Photography was still film. So it was basically you bought slide or color film, color negative film, or black and white film. I got a job at the local paper, and I started as a part-timer and then worked my way up to chief photographer. Wow. So within that time frame, you know, I learned a lot about black and white, how to process film, you know, what you can do with film. We would do ridiculous things with it. I mean, we'd push Tri-X to 3200 and know how to process it so that, you know, you have minimal grain on the product.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
All right. How did you get your first in-house role?
My first in-house?
Yeah, role.
Well, at the Air and Space Forces Association magazine, the Air and Space Forces magazine, I was the photo editor, but because I knew how to do pictures, I started helping them out with their conferences. Prior to that, you know, they either had someone else doing it or no one doing it, and I just stepped in and started photographing the conferences. The company also did not have a multimedia department. Back then, it was one person who volunteered to do it because he was interested in doing it. And they had one Walmart tripod with a very, very old digital camera on it, an old Canon, basically a palm quarter. So I stepped in to help, and what they did was they used at first my cameras as video cameras to shoot all their some of the major events. Gradually, they fleshed things out. We bought new dedicated 4K Panasonic cameras, bought three of those. We got a room that's dedicated to multimedia. We got video lights. We got teleprompters. We got a full-on control room.
Wow.
So it started basically from zero to this, mm-hmm. Over a span of a few years. So where we are now is we have a full-blown production team.
Wow.
It wasn't planned. It just happened naturally.
Mm-hmm.
What they found out was the people who work there, the bosses, liked the professional value that this added. And it gave more credibility to the Air and Space Forces Association. So right now, video and still photography is an integral part of the communications team that's there. That involves, I'd say, 8 to 10 people now, where before there were just 2 volunteers.
Oh, wow. That's impressive. That's a story right there.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to project a professional look,
mm-hmm.
then you need professionals to do it, you know?
Definitely.
And the people who are working there are very, very professional about their job, and they take it quite seriously. So
there you have it, guys. How does being an in-house photographer compare to being a freelance photographer or a hobbyist like myself? And how did it affect your enthusiasm or passion for photography?
I've always liked photography. So, you know, it never bothered me. You just, when you're an in-house photographer, it's like almost like being at a newspaper. You have to be ready for anything. Mm. Now, it could get boring for some people. I mean, naturally, there are a lot of, like, we call them grip and grin events, you know, check presentations or mm-hmm. just pictures of the boss with some dignitary.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the events that I cover, there's a lot going on, a lot of different things going on. You get to photograph a lot of important people. I mean, people who have spoken at our conference who have had a chance to photograph and meet up close, you know, there's been Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos.
Wow.
Sir Richard Branson.
Wow.
The Vice President of the United States came once. Secretary of the Air Force, Chief of Staff of the Air Force, Chief of Staff of the Space Force. I mean, you have all these people there that you're photographing, and the events themselves. You know, I'm going up to Capitol Hill mm-hmm. this coming week.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah, there's something different every day. So it's never boring.
That is amazing. All right, Mike. Is there any questions you have for me at all?
What was the most interesting video production that you've done so far?
I did my first short film. I did just on the fly. Shane and I are in a group that we had a film festival, but I chickened out. And I have bipolar disorder. So I did just basically, I set up my camera in one of my common areas of my apartment building and just sat it there. And I went through all the phases of mania, depression, and then stability. So in every scene, I repositioned my camera. So I got different angles of me in different moods. And then at the end, it's just me center frame and laughing about everything that just happened. And then I say in the camera, "Do you see me now?" And then end film, you see bipolar, and then filmed by Emerson Sanchez. And so that was probably my first video I've ever done. I put it on YouTube and I've gotten positive responses. I was like, this is the most amateur thing ever. I don't like it, but people have gotten, I don't know if it's because it's Mental Health Awareness Month or anything, but a lot of people were just like, this was deep. I was like, I didn't really put much thought into it, but a lot of people analyzed it and was all like, okay, this is where the rising action is. The climax is this. And I'm just like, whoa, how'd you guys know what I was, what I was filming in the storyboard I made? But yeah.
Well, you know, that just goes to show you too. And for a lot of people out there who obsess over equipment, it can come down not to really not the equipment. Mm-hmm. Content.
Yeah.
Content is king.
Yeah.
That's great. That's awesome.
Yeah. So right now I'm trying to figure out what other things I want to do, either with myself or with friends, just to really get the ball rolling, because I had so much fun filming that. And so all of your advice you gave about cinematic lighting and different lighting techniques, I'm going to utilize that in my next projects, definitely. But anyways, thank you, Mike, for being here. I've learned so much. I'm pretty sure Shane has learned a ton as well. And just, my brain is just, I'm mind blown by all of these, just picking Mike's brain, Mike sharing his skills and everything. You're incredible, man.
Wow. Thank you. I enjoyed being here. Uh-huh. And, Peach, I hope you're feeling better.
Yeah, Peach. Hope you'll be back for episode 17. Please. But anyways, thank you for listening to episode 16, everybody. I'm Emerson, your favorite mannequin melanated photographer, and I am out.
Thank you for listening to the Faute Bros Podcast. Feel free to follow us on Instagram @FauteBrosPodcast and follow us on X/Twitter @FauteBros.